This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street all across North Dakota this Sunday morning. And this morning, our show will feature two conversations from last week. The first will be with Luke Burbank, the host of Livewire Radio, which debuted on Prairie Public's statewide network yesterday evening. Then we'll talk with Jonah Lanto, the creative force behind Good Talk Minot, a series of programs that feature Minot personalities and issues and humor. And Tom Ezern will share a Plains Folk essay. First, we'll get a news update from News Director Dave Thompson.
Governor Doug Burgum has changed the goal for local COVID-19 task forces. Task forces in the Red River Valley and in Burley and Morton counties were established with the goal to bring the 14-day rolling average positivity rate from testing to below the statewide average rate. But that statewide rate has been above 5%, and Burgum says the new goal for task forces is to bring that rate down to the 5% level.
That gets you in the green zone for most all the national reporting areas. You know, that's a good goal for us, particularly with the high amount of testing that we're doing in the state.
The green zone indicates low risk for COVID spread. Eight North Dakota counties are in the yellow zone for higher risk. Schools across North Dakota are experiencing a shortage of substitute teachers, partially because of COVID-19. Many of the substitutes are retired teachers. But the Bismarck School District has come up with some ways to work around the shortages.
We have looked at our enrollment numbers at each of the schools, and we have offered to the schools that they could assign permanent subs for a few weeks, and we've actually extended that now through October 2nd.
Stacy Geiger is Human Resources Manager for Bismarck Public Schools.
And even if we have a school that may not be utilizing all their subs one day, we'll have another school call, you know, we'll reference them, say, hey, can you give a sub over to this school and help them out?
Geiger says many of the substitutes have interim substitute licenses.
You have to have completed 48 college credits. It used to be that they could sub no longer than 10 days for the same teacher. The governor just put an executive order out to lift that. So there's no longer restrictions. So that'll help for some of us to be able to bring those individuals in.
Geiger says there are about 359 substitute teachers active between Bismarck and Mandan Public Schools. The governing body of Minnesota High School Sports is reconsidering its decision to cancel fall sports. That could potentially open the door for football and volleyball to start across the state. The Minnesota High School League meets tomorrow to reconsider its decision to cancel the sessions. Ted Schultz has been activities director at Minnetonka Public Schools for more than a decade. He says his school district wants to get back on the field and back on the court.
Youth sports is wide open. Amateur sports are wide open. But the high school sports are restricted. And I will argue with anyone that our protocols in place that we've implemented here with our fall sports and our summer sports, from masking to temp checks to social distancing when possible, I think kids are safe.
Minnesota State Health Commissioner Jan Malcolm says high contact sports always pose some danger.
Of course, we're concerned about not just the games and the sports themselves, but the socialization that comes along with that. So we start to see more of these kinds of athletic events, it's just going to be extra important that everybody be aware of the risk and comply with social distancing and mask wearing guidance.
The North Dakota Legislature's budget section has approved a plan by the Bank of North Dakota to use $50 million on COVID relief money to help businesses pay down existing debt. The money comes from the CARES Act. The $50 million comes from an earlier $200 million allotment for an interest rate buy-down program. That program had to deal with new debt. But Bank of North Dakota President Eric Hardmeyer says he heard from a number of businesses that the issue was debt still on the books. This was approved by the state's Emergency Commission. Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner of Dickinson moved for approval.
As we move forward and we get out of this situation we're in, we've got to have viable business community. It is really critical that we keep our businesses rolling because they are the engine that is going to get this economy on track. It's the businesses that are going to help provide the revenue we need in the state so we can take care of the services that need to be done.
There were two votes against that program. House Appropriations Committee Chairman Jeff Delzer of Underwood objected to the $50 million amount.
I don't know that I have a problem with some of the ideas, but I would have much preferred we were starting this at a lower level, come in later on and see where we are and whether we needed to add to it. And frankly, I think we should have a little more of this money set aside waiting.
The bank will be working with local bankers to make the money available. The money will come in the form of grants. Air travel continues to recover in North Dakota. The North Dakota Aeronautics Commission says 43,559 people boarded airplanes in August at North Dakota's eight commercial airports. State Aeronautics Commission Director Kyle Wanner says since COVID-19 virtually shut down air travel in March, the state has seen passenger numbers grow. Wanner said it's good to see demand returning.
Still far below the pre-pandemic time, but at the same time, you know, these are encouraging numbers that we're seeing. And then the fact that North Dakota is recovering at a faster rate than, you know, the national average is also a good sign as well.
And Wanner says he senses a pent-up demand for air travel.
I think people obviously want to get back to the way things were, and you know, that may not be possible in the near term, but the prices are right now as well if you want to fly. And so there's a lot of positive aspects.
Wanner says
that
the airlines and airports are doing what they can to make sure that passengers have a safe experience. North Dakota's budget director says the state will end the current two-year biennium in the black. Joe Morissette told the legislature's budget section the state had been running ahead of the 2019-2021 budget forecast in terms of tax collections. Morissette says the COVID-19 pandemic did cut into those conditions starting in March, but he says the earlier, stronger collections give a budget cushion for the next two-year period.
We have an estimated ending balance at the end of this biennium of $160 million.
Before these latest numbers were released, there were concerns the governor would have to order an across-the-board budget allotment. Senate Appropriations Committee Chairman Ray Holmberg of Grand Forks says lawmakers have been getting questions from some state agencies concerning allotments. And he posed the question to Morissette, who said,
the need for an allotment would be based on a revised forecast that showed there was not adequate funding in the general fund to meet all the obligations that had been appropriated. And based on these estimates, we do not think that's the case. We think the general fund is adequate to cover those current appropriations.
For Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas, Director of Radio at Prairie Public. I want to take a moment to say thank you to all the people who have contributed during our fall membership drive here at Prairie Public. And without you, we could not do it. We had donations from across the region of all different levels, and we're sending out Prairie Public face masks to everybody who donated, and some people won some great prizes. So we had a lot of fun, and we're so happy to hear from you during this unusual time with so much news going on. We actually reduced the total amount of time that we spent talking about the drive because there was so much news going on, but you came through anyway, and we appreciate it. If you haven't had a chance to donate and want to, you can still participate in the fall drive for a couple more days by calling 800-359-4145 or going to prairiepublic.org.
You're listening to Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Live Wire Radio is a new program for Prairie Public. You can listen to it Saturday evenings at 6 Central. It's a variety show from Oregon Public Radio that features engaging guests, humor, and music. Last week we checked in with Luke Burbank, the show's host. He was hunkered down in his home to talk about his show and the career path that preceded it.
I am at my home in a town called Bellingham, Washington, which is kind of up in the far northwest corner of the U.S. I usually joke by saying I can see Canada from my house, but with the wildfires, I can barely see my neighbors from my house right now. It's pretty smoky out here.
So the air is not very good in Bellingham today.
Nope, it is. It has been described on the various websites as extremely unhealthy. So, you know, we're kind of battening down the hatches and trying to stay indoors mostly.
And I know that usually you record the show, Live Wire Radio, at the Alberta Rose Theater in Portland. Is that correct?
Yeah. In, as we call it now, the before times, We would get together in Portland, and we've got a raucous live audience and a house band. And I'm up there with the announcer, who's kind of my co-host, Elena Passarello. It's a really fun night of entertainment and, you know, hearing music and seeing comedians and the whole thing. So when the pandemic sort of reared its ugly head, things really changed for us. So we're now doing what we call the Livewire House Party, which is what Prairie Public listeners will be hearing for the foreseeable future. But it's been pretty amazing how much fun we're able to have and how much of the sort of energy of the regular show we've been able to create, even though we're all recording in our respective homes now. Our guests are Zooming in from wherever they might be in the country or in the world. And we're still trying to bring that live energy and that sense of discovery to the airwaves. And we're very excited to be on Prairie Public.
Well, you've got the fire, you've got the plague. I suppose you're waiting for the locusts now.
Yeah, but I think a frog just dropped out of the sky. Is that a bad sign?
Yeah. And I know that Portland is also dealing with bad air. And my daughter lives in Spokane, Washington. They've got air that is twice what is considered hazardous there. So our sunsets have been rosied up quite a bit. Our sky is hazy as well. The smoke has made it to us, and I think well east of us. But this is quite a story you're living among right now.
Yeah, I don't know how familiar you are, Doug, with the Star Wars movies, but it feels like we're on Tatooine.
Yes.
I think that planet Luke Skywalker, I'm looking at the sun right now directly. I'm like the president looking at a solar eclipse. I don't have sunglasses on, and I'm staring at the sun, but it's behind enough smoke that it's just a kind of it's just an orange orb, but it's not intense right now.
That's the same here. Give our listeners the elevator speech for the Luke Burbank story.
One of seven children, desperate for attention, childhood issues leading me to stand on stages in front of people, making what pass for as jokes, and hoping people will pay attention. I actually, when I was in college, I went to the University of Washington, and I was looking for a summer job, and in the student paper, they were advertising for a work-study job at the local public radio station in Seattle. And I had no idea what public radio was. And I liked the job, though, because it was indoors, which all my jobs previous to that had been working for plumbing companies and digging ditches and things like that. So
hard work.
Yeah. So I was excited to be inside sitting on an office chair, potentially. I think it paid $6 an hour, which was plenty of money for me in those days. And it turned out I was the only person that applied for the job. And they still turned me down, which is really hard to underwhelm people in an interview that much, that they do not offer the job to you as the only applicant. But I just kept bothering them. In fact, you know what? It's interesting, Doug. It was for a show at that time in Seattle called Weekday, which is, I think, very similar to the Main Street show that you do, public affairs and news and things like that. And I just kept calling them and bugging them. And finally, I just wore them down. So they said, fine, you can come in and you can answer you can listen to the voicemail line and transcribe the messages that are being left for us by various PR people and listeners. And so that was my first job. And from that inauspicious beginning, I've just kind of been in public radio for years. I have been really lucky that I've gotten some opportunities to host things, and it's gone all right. And so here I am, hosting Livewire Radio all these years later.
All things considered, you've reported for, as well as Morning Edition, and I noted on your Wikipedia file, everybody look for Luke Burbank online, you had a story that aired on This American Life 19 years ago.
Yeah, it was funny. It was the first story that I ever pitched to them, and they you know, bought it, I guess you would say, and it got on their show, and I was very excited about that. You know, I think I was like 22 or something, and I thought, well, this is easy. And that was 19 years ago. I've never gotten them to take another story of mine, but it was, I'll tell you, it was a fun experience. I was on an airplane flying home from Las Vegas, and a guy got on the plane dressed as Superman, like in the full costume, and he didn't have any luggage. I couldn't tell if he had a wallet or not. I mean, he was just dressed like Superman, and he just got on the plane, and everybody started sort of murmuring about it, like, you know, what's going on with this guy? And we had a layover in like San Jose or something. And so I went back to that part of the plane and said, what's going on with the outfit? And he started telling me his story, which was that he was somebody who had he had lost his wife in a car accident. He was not an old guy. He was probably in his mid-30s, and he just sort of decided life was too short to not follow your passion. And he really liked dressing up like Superman, thought it kind of brightened people's day. He liked getting into conversations about it. And so he just started doing it. In fact, he actually dressed like Batman in the wintertime because the Batman suit was warmer. It was like foam rubber. And in the summertime, he would go around dressed like Superman. And so I got to find out about his life, and that ended up on This American Life.
Well, I grew up when I was a kid, and it's a long time ago. I'm much older than you are. Superman was George Reeves on TV.
Yes. Yes.
You have also been a guest panelist and a substitute host for Peter Sagal on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. So some of our listeners have perhaps heard you on that show.
Yeah, that is a really, really fun gig because, you know, when you're one of the panelists, you're just up there with two other people who are always really funny. Peter is great. Bill Curtis is great. The callers are always fun. So you just get to kind of hang out with your friends. You make some jokes. Also, people who haven't been to a taping may not realize, but the show is taped on a Thursday night and then they edit it down. So it's kind of the best distilled version of it when you hear it on Prairie Public or wherever you might be listening. And I will tell you, as a contributor to the show, it really benefits from the editing because I throw a lot of stuff at the wall and only some of it sticks. In fact, it's kind of funny. Years and years ago, when I was living in L.A., I was sort of a cub reporter at NPR. And I somehow lucked into this gig of filling in as the host on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And I'll admit that I was only somewhat familiar with the show at the time. So I turned it on the public radio station there in L.A. This is like a week before I'm going to host it. And I am listening to this show, and it's Peter Sagal, and at the time, Carl Castle was the announcer.
Yes.
And it was so funny and so perfectly timed, and somehow they always went to the break right when the crowd was laughing or right when somebody said something funny. And I was so consumed by anxiety because I thought there's no way I'm going to be able to pull this off because I did not know the show was on tape. I thought this was all happening live and it was going to be my job to somehow run this three-ring circus. I got to Chicago to fill in for Peter because he had written a book, he was out promoting it. So I think I was going to host for a few weeks. And it wasn't until I got to Chicago and went to the offices of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me at Navy Pier that they explained to me that no, the show is on tape. So you don't have to do this live in one take because I was petrified. I almost didn't want to go to Chicago because I thought this is going to be a complete disaster. But it ended up going okay, and I've been with them ever since.
Well, I envy you doing this show when you don't have to Zoom it because of social distancing and all that at the Alberta Rose Theater because that's a nice venue, and it's really nice to have a live audience that you can see.
Yeah, it really is a big part of the show under normal circumstances is that kind of energy from the live crowd. It's kind of, whether it's Wait Wait or Livewire, it's really nice to have sort of an immediate barometer or indicator of how it's going, you know. And I can tell when I'm hosting Livewire, sometimes it's, you know, if I'm telling a story and it's, I can tell if it's working or not working, or, you know, if a bit we're trying with one of the guests. I mean, one of the things that we really like to do on Livewire is we take these guests and, you know, some of them are quite famous and some of them are people that you may not know about, but they're fascinating nonetheless. And we like to try to get them sort of out of their comfort zone a little bit because, you know, a lot of these people, particularly the ones that are pretty well known, you know, we've had folks like Salman Rushdie on the show comes to mind. And, you know, people may have heard an interview with him or read his books. And what we want to try to do is get him talking about his life or his world, maybe in a way that he hasn't before or in a way you haven't heard as the public radio listener. So we have this one bit we do. It's called The Jar of Truth. We have five questions in it. And they're kind of like icebreaker questions. We like to hype it up. We say these are the five essential questions of our time. But it turns out they're kind of banal, like questions like, is it okay to text on the way to somebody when you haven't left your house yet? Like maybe you haven't even taken the shower.
We've all done it.
You're on the way to take a shower to then be on the way. Like when is it socially acceptable to say I'm on the way? So like get Salman Rushdie or somebody answering a question like that is always fun. But when we're doing these bits and things, it's amazing because you can tell right in the moment if it's working or not, because you've got 400 or 500 people looking at you, and you can really read what's going on in the room. So that energy adds a lot to the show. And it's really fun, a part of the regular broadcast. But again, I have been really happy with how much energy we've been able to generate, even in this version of the show. You know, a lot of other public radio shows have pivoted the way we have. You know, we're all doing these programs from home, and I think with varying degrees of success. I really feel like LiveWire and the LiveWire House Party. In fact, you know, Doug, there's a certain reach we have now that we didn't have before, because it used to be the people we would have on the show were the people that happened to be in Portland on a particular night, or that we could get out to Portland. And now it's, you know, it's anybody in the world, really. If they can get to an internet connection, they can be on our show. And that's really helped us. You know, the conversation around the Black Lives Matter movement and things like that have been really prominent culturally. And we've been able to reflect that on our show. We've been able to get people on the program from all kinds of places, talking about all kinds of topics. That could have been more challenging when we were in at one geographic location in Portland. So there are some silver linings to this whole thing, even though I think I speak for everyone when I say we're pretty much ready for it to be done.
Amen. Luke, you hinted at this. How do you deal with the elephants in the current events closet, like the fires, the protests that Portland was ground zero for that for quite a while, and the upcoming election for that matter?
It's really a challenge these days. I mean, I think we really work to be, since this is public radio, we try to keep our thumb off the scale, you know, as much as possible. When we talk about politics, we certainly try to sort of keep our own personal political beliefs sort of off the air. But it's also a really anxious time to be living in this country, you know, with the stuff that's going on with the pandemic, with the stuff that's going on with politics. And then again, as you mentioned earlier, looking outside and seeing, you know, the smoke descending on us, it feels like a metaphor for something. So, you know, we try to walk that tightrope. I mean, our guests are certainly free to talk about their feelings, and we have a lot of opinionated guests on the show. And, I mean, one of the things that we've done is really week in and week out, since we went to this modified model during the pandemic, we're really just trying to speak honestly about our experience in the world. I'm talking about myself as the host and Elena Passarello as the announcer, because that's all you can do. I mean, the week that George Floyd was killed, what we talked about on our show was I was having some real deep questions as to if I was the right person to host LiveWire, because I'm another white guy. And we got a lot of white guys hosting these public radio shows. And that was a week of soul searching, I think, for all of us. I think that's soul searching that hopefully we're all still doing, because the issues of structural racism in this country are far from being solved. But, you know, I mean, LiveWire is the kind of show where if it's on a given week, I'm really struggling with the question of if I should still be the host of the show. We'll talk about it on the show, because I don't know how to do it any other way. I've never been very good at keeping. Sometimes I'll go into a particular episode of the show or a recording and I'll say to myself, you have one job, Burbank, don't bring this topic up, or don't bring up, you know, this thing that happened to you. And that is a guarantee that within 5 minutes I will be talking about it, because I just don't have that ability to keep things to myself. And so, I mean, I'm really have to say, kind of proud of LiveWire in that I think we're extremely transparent. And I think we just are who we are, and we have to sort of live and die by that, because we're not good at putting up any kind of a front. So we're living in this very, very kind of at times scary, at times confusing, and at times really beautiful world. We're living in that world along with the Prairie Public listeners, and we're trying to just reflect that back to them.
I listened to last week's show, as I mentioned, and it started with you and Elena having a discussion about the risks you've taken, and you had a Lollapalooza to share. Give our audience a sense of the risk you had recently experienced.
Oh, my goodness. I had a little vacation time, but of course, because of the pandemic, those sorts of decisions are made very differently now. And so a buddy of mine had a sailboat. And he had recently been tested for COVID and was negative. I had recently been tested. And so we went out on this sailboat of his for a week out in the San Juan Islands, which is a beautiful chain of islands off the coast of Washington State. And by the way, the term for that is gunk-holing, which sounds...
Haven't heard that before.
Sounds like something you can't say on public radio, but I guess that just means to go from, you know, little cove to cove or port to port. So we were out there doing that, and at some point found ourselves in the unfortunate situation where the a length of rope that was securing the kind of smaller boat called the tender that you take to go to shore, that boat, which was being towed behind the sailboat, the rope got caught in the propeller, which meant the sailboat was dead in the water and was drifting towards some rocks. And the only way that we could remedy the situation was to strip down to our skivvies. I mean, we didn't have time to go put on like swim trunks and sort of just dive under the boat with a knife. And let me also clarify, this is not, we're not in Malibu, California.
This is cold water.
This is very cold, like, you know, northwest water where, I don't know, maybe, it felt like it was 35 degrees, but probably it was a little warmer than that. It was cold enough that it absolutely took your breath away. And so we alternated, my buddy Evan and I alternated diving under the boat and using this knife to hack away at this rope. And I mean, moments before we drifted into these rocks, I got the last little bit off, which had been very tightly wound around the propeller. And when I came back out from under the boat, holding that little last section of rope aloft, I got to tell you, I have never felt more manly. In fact, it might have been the first time I ever felt manly in my life, but it was almost worth the sheer terror. It was just one of those moments where if I could have done anything, if there's any way I could have not been assigned this task, I would have. Like, you know what I mean? This was the last thing I wanted to do because it was kind of terrifying. The propeller was pretty far under the boat. You had to be underneath a fairly substantial sailboat, like, you know, so I didn't want to do it. I know my buddy didn't want to do it, but we got through it, and it was now it's a great story. So I'll be dining out on this story for years to come, I'm sure.
I've been shivering just listening to you tell that story because I know how cold that water is.
It was cold.
Well, how would you describe your target audience?
I would hope it'd be, you know, the typical Prairie Public listener, which is somebody who is curious about the world. I mean, the way that we try to structure each episode of Livewire is usually somebody who you may have heard of, somebody who's probably fairly well known, particularly to public radio listeners, and then maybe somebody that you haven't heard of, but who we think you're really going to get some new information with. I mean, I know public radio listeners are often described as having a lifelong love of learning. That's the ideal demo for us. And I know you've got a lot of listeners that fit that bill. So we're so excited to be on your station.
Luke Burbank is the host of Live Wire Radio.
Thanks so much for talking to me. I had fun.
You can tour the working studios of some of Fargo-Moorhead's most popular artists during this year's Studio Crawl, October 3rd and 4th, noon to 6. See painters, potters, printers, photographers, fabric artists, and glass artists all demonstrating their work and talking about what life is like for a working artist. You can find Studio Crawl brochures at many locations around Fargo-Moorhead or find one at prairiepublic.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Benedictine Health System, providing health and housing services to older adults in communities across North Dakota and Minnesota. BHSHealth.org.
And by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at BushFoundation.org.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas, Director of Radio at Prairie Public. I want to take a moment to say thank you to all the people who have contributed during our fall membership drive here at Prairie Public. And without you, we could not do it. We had donations from across the region of all different levels, and we're sending out Prairie Public face masks to everybody who donated, and some people won some great prizes. So we had a lot of fun, and we're so happy to hear from you during this unusual time with so much news going on. We actually reduced the total amount of time that we spent talking about the drive because there was so much news going on. But you came through anyway, and we appreciate it. If you haven't had a chance to donate and want to, you can still participate in the fall drive for a couple more days by calling 800-359-4145 or going to prairiepublic.org.
Joining me now on Main Street is Jonah Lento. He is the owner of the Good Talk Network, and we talked a while back, Ashley Thornburg did, with one of his associates about Good Night Live, which is a sort of a TV show that's produced in Minot by the same organization that Jonah has. Jonah, thanks for joining us today.
Doug, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
We have you on today to talk about your enterprise and this other show you do, the Good Talk show, and give us a little background here. How did all this get started?
Really, it got started back in 2016, November 16th, 2016, the first episode of The Good Talk aired, and it started as a hobby between myself and a good friend, Chris Rubb, and really, we wanted to have contextualized conversations, ask big questions, and really have fun through the experience. Our hope was that through perspective-filled conversations, we could inspire new ideas, new paths of inquiry, maybe new lines of thinking, and help people grow their bubble just a little bit. And that's really where we got our start. Through there, it snowballed into several other projects. I met Josh Walsky. We began the Good Talk Minot, which was a Minot-centric podcast with a local focus on things happening here in our city in which the show was produced. Keeping my door open to opportunity, we progressively leveled up our production capabilities, continued to have interesting guests on the show, expanded our content offerings. I started producing other subsidiary podcasts that would come out underneath the Good Talk Network banner, stuff like the Game of Thrones cast. We did a football show. We do After the First Glass. Now we do a show called Myth America, which is an American history podcast. We're producing a true crime show called Midwest Murder, which is expected to debut in October. And really, yeah, it's been quite the journey. And of course, last year in 2019, we began producing the late night comedy talk show Good Night Live with host Jake Thraukill with a really talented group of people.
Wow. Well, let's get into the title here. What is Good Talk to Jonah Lento?
To me, it's a vehicle for perspectives, conversations, ideas. Really, the Good Talk Network is just that. It's a network of ideas. So people ask, well, what is your show about? Well, when it's the Good Talk, it's an organic conversation-based interview that I have with a guest. But underneath that, the Good Talk Network also produces Myth America. We produce The Ed Head Show, which is hosted by Dan Kahn and Chelsea Holtz. It's an education-based podcast and really phenomenal stuff. So usually most of our shows are on Facebook Live. It's the Good Talk Network on Facebook, and then we release them in podcast form. So yeah, it's really fantastic.
And people can find it at thegoodtalknetwork.com. You've got your offerings up there, links to various shows and all of that. So this started in the basement of your home in Minot, and now you've got all these other shows. How do you find these people? Are you all like, is there a Minot State connection? What's the common ground here?
The common ground, Doug, is through my life, I've learned to say yes and keep my door open to ideas and opportunities. As I began to acquire, I started this show in the basement, and people got to walk past my washer and dryer to get to what was the basement studio. And during that time, I'm a guy in a basement making a podcast, and I've got the mayor of my city. I've got sheriffs coming through, state legislators, the president of the university, professors, people who want to get a message out, people who want to have a conversation about big topics. We're coming into my home, into my studio to have these conversations. So really, the contacts, I'm not an alumni of Minot State University or anything like that. I just kept my door open for opportunities, ideas, and relationships.
So you've got all these shows now that are produced by the Good Talk Network, your organization that you started. Does that Is that a full-time job now, or do you have a day job?
It is a full-time job. It is my day job, and I can't tell you that it pays great, but I'm getting by. I'm having a lot of fun. I'm meeting some incredible people now. We've released nearly 700 shows since 2016. I've interviewed personally more than 300 people, Olympians, authors. Dr. Mark Lehner was on the show. Just a lot of really incredible people who are making a difference in the world.
What do you consider to be the big issues that folks in Minot should be talking about? Aside from the things that interest you, what do you think energizes an audience?
Really, we put a strong focus on our nonprofit sector a lot in the Minot area, and it sometimes is easy to overlook the very important and relevant work that the nonprofit community does, how their efforts contribute to the economic fertility of a city, as well as the social happiness that we get from what a lot of these nonprofits do. So over time, the Good Talk Minot show has focused quite a bit on that aspect of our city. We also put a lot of emphasis on the artistic endeavors that people are accomplishing here in such a small area. We're recognized as so many talented people making music or theater, or now us, we're making comedy. There's all of these really blossoming artistic endeavors that I wonder sometimes, do they get overlooked in such a small place? You know, Minot recently made national news, and unfortunately, it was kind of for some ugliness that came out during a city council meeting. And yes, I would like to put and shine a light more on all of the amazing things that are happening here from the talented people accomplishing them. It's really a bit tragic. That's what puts North Dakota on the spotlight, when in fact there are people doing absolutely phenomenal things here.
That way, you're talking about the council member who was confronted and talked about LGBTQ issues in the city, and that would seem to be a relevant topic.
Indeed. Yes, it is.
Now, you don't broadcast from your basement anymore, or podcast from your basement anymore. Where do you do it now?
No, Doug. So in April of 2019, we got out of the basement. I had a really amazing planning session with some brilliant minds, and we looked from the top down. Where could this go? Where can the Good Talk Network go, and how do we get out of the basement? So we started with the big goal, the big dream. If we made it to the end game, where we'd like to be on this journey, and we worked our way backwards from there. Came up with a plan, put a plan into motion, and I got here into the Good Talk studio. It's north of Minot. Last year in April. So we began broadcasting all of our shows live in studio here. And then again, yeah, they're released in podcast form wherever podcasts can be found.
Now, you mentioned broadcasting. You've had some collaborations with the Mouse River Players in Minot State. Are you then on the cable system in Minot? And if so, does that affect the content of the show?
We have previously been on the local cable access channel 19 through the Minot State University. So in prior times, you could catch our content offerings there. And really, since the pandemic, we have not reinitiated that partnership. But so no, at this point, there are no limitations. We're, of course, not ruled by the FCC on what we do here.
Yes.
We put our stuff out live on Facebook and then release it after the fact.
So when you're not broadcasting, you have fewer boundaries in terms of language and subject matter, that kind of thing. And I noted that one of your Good Night Minot shows featured drinks in an audience.
Absolutely, yeah. We want people to cut loose at the Good Night Live shows. So there's full beverage offerings, and I would say our content with the late night comedy show certainly is PG-13 or a very soft R rating. However, I'd say that our recent show, which was the Good Night Live roast of Sean Sitma, that was by far our most vulgar show. But what can you expect? It's a roast.
Joe Nolento is the owner of the Good Talk Network. He's got lots of shows that are produced under that mantle. Has the pandemic helped to raise your profile? I mean, people shut in and looking for something to do or watch or listen to.
That's a good question, Doug. Our Our downloads and our presence has been pretty consistent. I would say even us during the initial pandemic, we were really set up so much to be in studio and to have guests in studio. And so for a time, I wasn't really doing many remote interviews while we were in studio, because the in-studio experience is just so much better. You can really engage with somebody. You're looking them in the eye. And so initially, when the pandemic hit, we probably had about a 4 to 6 week hiatus where we really didn't get any new content out there. And I sort of developed some alternative plans, got some different software, learned it, and then began pulling in more remote guests. And so we have been able to kind of transition and adapt to that, but it was a pivot. It was really a bummer, Doug. I worked so hard to get out of my basement and into the studio. And then suddenly the pandemic strikes. We had a lot of amazing things potentially happening for the Good Night Live show, and that now suddenly I'm forced back into the basement. I had to find and dig out my old USB camera and again really find a way to deliver the good talk from home again. So that was discouraging, but I didn't let it get me down.
How do you assess the response? How do you know who's watching or listening? I mean, broadcast uses ratings, although those can be a bit suspect at times, because now we've got this broadcast and online presence for most program originators. How do you know how many people are out there or are listening? Is it downloads? How do you assess that?
Yes. So between our online views as well as our downloads, and that's the main assessment, the program that I use, and I think pretty much any podcast hosting service will provide those analytics that you want to see to know that, hey, we're still getting downloaded. People are listening. Really, we set out with a goal of 10 listeners, so we've come a long way from there, Doug.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that this is your day job now, but how about the other folks? Is this a volunteer effort largely, or, you know, is everybody in it for, everybody got some skin in the game, if you will?
It's a little bit of both. Really, there's an investment of time, and there's an investment of time and effort that goes into it. So everybody working on the Good Night Live project is coming home with a payday. It was a volunteer effort in the beginning, but through the selling of sponsorships and our ticket sales, and we've got some merchandise. So we do pay everybody that works on the late night show. There's no, of course, to come in and be a Good Talk guest. We don't pay our guests to come on in the studio and have a chat with us or anything like that. But the rest of it, yeah, for me, I'm the only person full-time employed underneath the banner of the Good Talk, but certainly a lot of freelance work is being put out there from us.
What is Jonah Lanto's background? What sparked your interest in getting into this?
That's a very good question. What sparked my interest in getting into this, I would have to give a lot of credit to the Joe Rogan Experience podcast. Listening to him in long-form conversation, it showed me there was an alternative to news bites. And for me, oftentimes when we're in the world that we live in now with social media, there's a lot of clickbait. There's a lot of manipulation of words to get someone to think a certain way. And at the heart of what we do here, I don't want to tell people how to think. We're not talking heads trying to be right. There's no driving point of being right or wrong in conversations on this show. There's the discussion, the perspective that comes with it, and the encouragement that you'll take that information and think for yourself and formulate your own ideas and your own conclusions without me having to string you along. So we were really heavily inspired by that idea, and that if even on a, and that change, positive change, doesn't start from the top. It starts small. It starts local. If you can sort of infect somebody with this really great, unique, and positive idea, and they take that away and they share it with one of their friends, and then so on and so forth, suddenly from this really small focal point, a pin drop, if you will, in a place like Minot, we spread our network. And it's a network of ideas and positive thinking and openness and empathy. And that's that was what inspired us to be where we are. And certainly it's not without comedy, where we did a show called The Coffee Talk for a time, where we would find some of the most obnoxious headlines and hilarious stories throughout the country, and then we talk about them and just break them down. Or one big question, one of our most downloaded podcasts ever was quite a while back, but there was an article written, I think it was in Popular Mechanics a few years back, that artificial intelligence could someday write its own Bible. Will people worship it? And so we literally just took that article and that idea and had like a 2.5 hour conversation about it with people of different philosophies and different lines of thinking. And some of our conclusions through that discussion, I think, would really surprise people.
Huh. So it's good talk, my not. It's my not oriented stuff now. But in 5 or 10 years, why not good talk North Dakota?
Why not good talk Midwest?
Yeah, or that's, U.S.
or U.S., indeed. Well, that's certainly among the goals. Our efforts with Good Night Live, we want to be the show, the late night show of the Midwest. Late night talk shows are very coastal. If I were to say, if I ask anybody, what's the biggest talk show? What's the biggest late night show in the Midwest? Does anybody have an answer for that? Is there a late night talk show that represents us?
Not that I know of. So go for it, Jonah.
We're on our way.
Jonah Lanto is the owner of the Good Talk Network. He's got lots of shows that you can watch and listen to at thegoodtalknetwork.com. Jonah, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Doug. I appreciate your time.
African Soul American Heart protects orphan girls from South Sudan from forced marriage by keeping them in school until they're adults and able to make their own choices about their futures. Learn more at asahinsudan.org.
This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezrin is a familiar voice to our listeners. He's a history professor at NDSU, an author, a performer, and the creative force behind the Plainsfolk essays we feature on our show. Today, Tom sings and examines a folk song titled, "The Farmer Is the Man."
Oh, the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, but the farmer is the man who feeds them all. If you'll only look and see, then I think you will agree that the farmer is the man who feeds them all. Well, yes, we do have to agree that the farmer is the man who feeds them all, because given what we have learned about the capacity of indigenous peoples to manage landscapes for food production, there is no clear line between farming and hunting and gathering. So the farmer feeds them all. But who would sing a song like the one I just quoted the first stanza of? This is an old folk song that still has some currency. I know it appears annually in the Summer Camp Songbook of the Farmers Union of North Dakota. I have students at North Dakota State University who learned the song at camp. On the other hand, people like me, who took some ag econ in college, are a little sheepish about the farmer is the man. We were taught that this sentiment is called farm fundamentalism, that it represents an old-fashioned attitude which gets in the way of efficiency and enterprise. Farmers should forget about being the man and just be regular business people. I have sung "The Farmer is the Man" over the years without knowing its certain origins. I have said, this is an old traditional song popular in the days of the Farmers' Alliance and the People's Party of the 1890s. It had a resurgence in currency during the agricultural discontent of the 1930s. Other than that, origins and history of the song were fuzzy. No longer. Having done some deep searching, I can say without doubt that the song, "The Farmer is the Man," was presented to the public precisely on January the 14th, 1874. Its author was a man named Knowles Shaw. Knowles Shaw, born in Ohio, was an old-time evangelist who preached across the Midwest until eventually making his way to Kansas. He is best remembered as a hymn writer, the composer of the gospel standard, Bringing in the Sheaves, and in his time was known as the singing evangelist. On arriving in Kansas, he found an eruption of farm fundamentalism in progress. Farmers, discontented with prices, credit, and transportation, were organizing in local associations called granges. The granges affiliated to form the National Grange of the Patrons of Husbandry, its members known as grangers. Shaw must have liked the evangelical fervor of the organized farmers, because under his name, in the Osage Mission Journal, Osage Mission, Kansas, of January 14, 1874, appeared a poem entitled, "The Farmer is the Man That Feeds Us All." Given Shaw's propensity for singing, I am certain he sang this poem. As did, soon after, multitudes of grangers attending grange rallies, and other newspapers reprinted the song for their convenience. The granger movement faded, but during the 1890s, the populists spread the song from Georgia to North Dakota and all places agricultural. Shaw's song differs a bit from the version we know today. The first two lines have more feet in them. But Shaw's is unmistakably the original version of the popular folk song, informing us across the centuries, "We may say whate'er we can, yet the farmer is the man. Yes, the farmer is the man that feeds us all."
That's Tom Ezern.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
We hope you've enjoyed Main Street Weekend, and we invite you to join us for Main Street Weekdays at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. You can also listen live online and access our Main Street podcast anytime at prairiepublic.org. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Sunday.